Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt and taxes and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, with a love of fantasy books and funk, and a hatred of running more than 3 miles, Dave Denniston.
My name is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the latest episode of the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, have you been wondering, how the heck can I pay less in taxes? Well, if you've been grappling with that kind of question, or maybe you're just curious about getting educated more about it, you are going to love our next guest. Her expertise lies in the area of tax planning. As a matter of fact, proactive tax planning. And her goal is to make sure successful physicians and entrepreneurs across the country are paying the least amount of tax that they can legally pay, of course, without getting thrown in jail. And as a matter of fact, she is a tax coach. She offers a free tax analysis for anyone who's interested in finding out how they may overpay. And as a matter of fact, I ran across her originally because I heard her in another podcast, and I thought that she would add tons of value to you. I know we're going to learn a lot today. Please help me welcome Diane Gardner. Welcome, Diane.
Hey, David. It's so wonderful to have the opportunity to be on your podcast today. So thanks for having me.
No, thank you. Thank you, Diane. Well, just give us a quick 1 or 2 minute overview. Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
Well, I am an accountant and certified tax coach who operates out of northern Idaho, a little tiny town called Rathdrum, Idaho, about 6,000 people. But the great thing is I get to work nationwide. And so I get to pick up physicians, entrepreneurs all across the country who think they're overpaying their taxes and get to take a look at them. And most of the time I'm able to assure them that, yes, they are, but that's okay, we can fix it, and then come up with a plan to help them legally pay down and plan their way to a lower tax liability, which makes me a tax superhero. Instead of somebody saying, oh, by the way, Dr. So-and-so, you owe $67,922 on your taxes or whatever, and then they really don't like you. So my clients look forward to meeting with me because we're constantly working on this plan, revising it, updating it, helping them know exactly where they're going to be and making sure that they're not overpaying their taxes.
Well, what I think is so interesting, which you're kind of bringing up here, is there's a lot of CPAs that I call bean counters. So they're good at counting beans. They ask people to send in a bunch of stuff, and they prepare the forms, and they prepare everything correctly, which is great and fine and dandy. But they really miss out on the tax planning portion, which is a great deal of the things that I talk about on this podcast, as well as the thing that you want to be is proactive in trying to reduce these taxes. So can you tell us about the difference between what most CPAs do and kind of what you do?
David, most accountants and tax preparers, I'm going to lump them all into one group there, are just really great at what we call recording history. They can take a look at your financial statements. They can take a look at your tax returns. They can take a look at all the different pieces of documents and stuff that you give them and maybe create a beautiful-looking tax return or a financial analysis or a cash flow statement or whatever. They do really good at doing that, but then they kind of just stop. And they say, okay, project is done, because that's the engagement that you engage them to do. Then there's a whole group of us out there who have taken some advanced training, and we say, let's help you plan the future. And so that is the difference, is recording the history versus planning the future. Now, those of us who help plan the future can also help record your history, because that's just part of what we do. But the fun and the magic starts in being able to plan for that future, being able to sit down and maybe start with a projection of where we think you're going to end up for this year, and then roll that out into maybe a 3-year plan and take a look at various tax strategies and see how they could affect that 3-year plan and come up with, if you did this, this could happen. If you did that, this is what this outcome would be, and allow you to take control of your own destiny instead of just taking whatever you're handed from your account and your tax repair and saying, this is what it is, and I'm done, file it away, and move on.
Well, I got to imagine there's someone listening to this right now. They say, okay, this sounds all nice and grand and fantastic, but tell me about some ways that you could show me how you could end up saving people money and taxes. So, Dan, can you think of maybe two or three mistakes in proactive tax planning that a common CPA might make that you could think of that could help our audience of people who are listening out there right now?
Well, David, probably the biggest one that I see the most often is a self-employed physician or other entrepreneur who is in the wrong entity type. And I see this most often. They're either operating as a sole proprietor or maybe in a general partnership. And if they were in a different entity type, they could pick up a whole bunch of money in tax saving strategies as well as adding in some liability protection. And where those tax saving strategies come in is in saving a self-employment tax. Because when you're a sole proprietor or a single member LLC who's not done anything, therefore you're taxed as a sole proprietor or a general partnership, 100% of your net profits is subject to self-employment tax of 15.3%. So if we're able to start taking part of that profit and making part of it into something like wages and the rest into net profit that's not subject to self-employment tax, that's where the magic starts happening. And to do that, a whole analysis needs to be done. It's not something you just start checking the box and, okay, I'm going to jump from this entity to this entity. But you can start saving a lot of money for people, just something as simple as you've outgrown your entity type.
So let's break that down a little bit. So what we're talking about here might be forming a subchapter S corporation or an LLC, which can get treated like a subchapter S corporation.
Correct. Right, yeah, and that depends on the state that you're in, because some states are very LLC-friendly and others aren't. So we have to take, you know, a lot of things that go into making that decision.
So tell us a little bit more about that. When is a state better for an LLC rather than an S-corp or vice versa?
Well, I'll give you one example. Here in the state of Idaho, we are a very LLC-friendly state, and what I've been told by local business attorneys that in the state of Idaho, an LLC actually gives you more legal protection than an S-corp does. And so knowing that, when I'm looking at a client, I'm looking at them to see, are they a good fit for an LLC, not just for tax planning purposes, but for legality and for limitation of liability. And of course, I'm not an attorney, so I'm just looking at really broad strokes, and then we send them off to an attorney to make sure we're doing this right. But then, can we take that LLC and maybe look to see if we can have it get permission from the IRS to be taxed as that S corporation? So we've given them the maximum liability protection, and we've also given them the tax savings. Compare that to the state of California, who is not LLC friendly at all. California has a minimum corporate tax that they charge their S corps of $800 and their LLCs, but they also have a gross revenues tax that they charge LLCs. So you don't see very many LLCs in the state of California. So that's the kind of stuff you have to really get in and look at as I'm working across the nation of making sure, you know, the state that you're in, is it an LLC-friendly state or not before you start looking at the LLC side of things. But it is one of my favorite planning tools because it's a very flexible entity type because it's a hybrid.
Well, let's talk to the kind of advantages and disadvantages of doing that a little bit, because there's probably some physicians out there that are listening where they have a normal W-2 wage job. They're working for a hospital, but maybe they're doing some 1099 locums on the side. There might be someone else who's listening that owns their own practice, so they get majority of their income from their practice, maybe some other investments and that kind of thing. So if we think about those two situations, first someone that has a current job and they're getting 1099 income, should they be thinking about one of these kind of entities? Is there still a tax favored status for them that could help out or not?
I would say they definitely should be thinking about one of these types of entities. If for no other reason than the limitation of liabilities. So if we can put a fence around what you're doing as you're in an industry that does have a lot of potential for liability out there, So if we could look at an LLC or an S-corp or even a, probably not a C-corp because that puts you into a personal services corp, but if we can look at some of these other entities of house and liability protection, that would be a good thing potentially, just to limit that part of it, as well as then looking at it from the tax standpoint. Because right now, if they're doing nothing, they're paying that wonderful self-employment tax of 15.3% on 100% of their net profit, which is probably most of their earnings. And self-employment tax is the Social Security and Medicare part of the amount that's withheld when you're an employee. So if you're wages are high enough, depending on the split between W-2 and 1099 income, you may not be paying a lot of self-employment tax. So that's why you kind of have to see the whole picture before you make a definitive yes or no answer on that question.
Well, that's usually, if I remember correctly, around 120K is that breakoff point where you still have to pay Medicare taxes, but you no longer have to pay the Social Security part of the
Social Security piece, right.
So if someone has a W-2 that's over 120K from their normal hospital job, the tax part of the entity may not make as much sense, perhaps.
Correct, right, which is why you want to do that whole analysis and look at it, because you want to make sure that before you jump into another entity that there's good, strong reasoning behind it, because when you do jump into a new entity, there's potentially some of the costs that go along with it, and costs like having additional tax returns prepared, mm-hmm. having to keep another set of books, some of those kinds of things. So you want to make sure that you know what your costs are in addition to what the benefits are before you make that type of a jump.
Absolutely. So for our W-2 wage people, that they don't even have any 1099 income, do you have two or three tax hints that might be good to pass on to them that could help reduce their taxes?
Well, one of the things I see the most, if there's any way that you can come up with some sort of a sideline type business, whether you know it's something small that maybe you know that you could are doing that you know maybe could be pulled away from the W-2 job, and create yourself a small little business, that gives you the opportunity to write off some things that maybe you've just been paying for out of pocket. And one of those examples would be the ability to hire your kids to work in that business or hire your spouse to work in that business, which allows you to take a pre-tax deduction for things that you've been paying after tax, like funding camps and things like that for your kids and private schooling and things like that. If there's a way we can hire those kids to work in this business, we can potentially fund those other activities via paying your kids a payroll out of your business. So we move it from an after-tax to a pre-tax location.
I love that idea. That's a great one.
All right. Well, let's take a pause here for a second and go to our commercial break. Well, if you are like some members of my audience, you are committed to being an amazing doctor and succeeding at life. But the truth is, you never receive financial training during medical school, and you struggle with enough time to do it all. Well, my friends, I am committed to increasing your financial knowledge and all this jargon you may hear tossed around. I am committed to helping guide you through this confusing maze of financial decisions that you know you need to make. Paying off debt, reducing taxes, saving for college, and so much more. And that's why this month I have a special offer for you. You can pick up my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only $1. That's right, the whole copy, a physical copy, for only $1. You can visit the podcast website now at www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar, D-O-L-L-A-R, to pick up your copy. I simply ask you help to pick up the cost of shipping it to you. So don't let this podcast be like other ones where you hear great information, you get these new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. To snag your copy now, visit www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar. Again, that's www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar.
Now, this is something that I'm super passionate about, which is that there's a lot of physicians, and some of them may be listening to this, where they're just feeling burned out. They just aren't enjoying the practice of medicine anymore with all the EMRs and the inundation of paperwork and electronic records that they have to fill out. And so some of them might be looking to start, we call a side hustle. And I know this is something for you that you've been focusing on doing, that you weren't always on podcasts and being guests on shows such as this. So I'd love to hear from you a little bit, Diane, to help educate, give a little bit of business education to our listeners. How did you start what you're doing in terms of a side hustle, and what has that journey been like for you?
Well, I'm going to say, David, it was a forced journey, and I'm going to back that up and go back into 2008, 2009, when our economy was crashing down around us. I was very heavily into the blue-collar industries, a lot of contractors and specialty contractors, and a lot of those kind of people were my clientele back then. Well, we all kind of know what happened, and as we remember back in that era, they were going out of business right and left because the real estate market was crashing. And so that was causing my clients to drop like flies, but yet they still needed final bookkeeping done, final tax returns done, all that kind of stuff. And so I was left with a huge amount of accounts receivable and no way to collect on it. And so at that point in time, I had just purchased my office building in 2007 at the height of the market. 2008 and 2009, everybody's crashing, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do? And so decided I needed to learn how to market and start attracting a niche that wasn't as susceptible to our local economy, and start attracting clientele who were a little more insulated. And so that started me on my journey of learning how to market, because accountants are notorious for not knowing how to market. We've all had that proverbial, hang up your shingle and they will come. So,
well, it's almost like a dirty word.
I think both
in medicine and accounting, and even in my world, you know, I'm in such a highly regulated industry. It's like, ooh, marketing. You know, everyone has to come kind of organically, and
right.
You know, it becomes this big hassle.
And other accountants have looked at me like, why are you doing that? You know, but it's once I had shifted my mindset to this world of learning how to market, I actually really enjoy it now. It's one of my favorite things to do, and that sounds really funny to hear that from somebody who was completely content to just stay behind the scenes and sit at my desk and work before. So over the period of time, I learned how to do these podcast interviews and radio show interviews and that type of stuff. I became an author. I have 8 books out there now. I've learned how to put on some seminars and those types of things, which stretched me so far way outside my comfort zone that I don't even know where my comfort zone is anymore. But it was all necessary to change the type of clientele that I was going after, to become somebody who was desirable for people who had never, ever met me, was to have to change the way I was doing things and to change the way that I was approaching people. Instead of sitting back at my desk waiting for it to come, I needed to be out there and be more visible.
Tell me just more about that. You know, it sounds like there was this huge mindset shift where you had to take action. And was this a big investment of money, time, both? You know, what has that been? 8 books, that's a lot.
That is.
I got to imagine someone said, 8 books, the physician that's listening to this, I don't have time for that. what would that look like? What would be your advice to someone that maybe wants to start a side hustle to attract people so maybe they don't have to be in medicine anymore?
Right. Well, I'm going to, as I say, open the kimono a little bit for you and say that my first 2 books were co-authored books. And in a co-authored book, you basically buy your way in. And you pay a fee, and then you submit your chapter, and they pull the book together, and they do everything, and they make it a bestseller, which allowed me to be able to say I'm a best-selling author right out the gate. Then from there, then I started writing my own books. Now, I have had some ghostwriting help on a couple of them because I just flat out did not have the time. And so you can hire ghostwriters. If you give them a basic outline of what you want to talk about, what you want to say, they're really good at writing. they're a better writer than I ever am. And so, you know, you can go that route. It's perfectly acceptable. It's perfectly legal and everything. So in a couple of my books, there's been several sections where I've had somebody just get this done because I was not getting to it fast enough. Some of the books I've actually written all the way myself. A couple of the books, I've taken one of my books and I've made some niche variations of it. And so that created a couple extra books by just going in and changing some words a little bit to apply to a particular niche. And an example of that is I have a free book that I give away on my website called The 10 Most Expensive Tax Mistakes That Cost You Thousands. Well, I also have one that says The 10 Most Expensive Mistakes That Cost Real Estate Professionals Thousands or That Cost Contractors Thousands. And here real soon we'll have one that says It Costs Physicians Thousands. So that's one way that you can start getting some multiple books out there without having to totally, completely start from scratch and write.
Well, thank you for that transparency and just sharing that with the audience and being vulnerable, because I think that's something that a lot of people could do. You mentioned hiring a ghostwriter. You mentioned just piecing out parts of it and doing multiple versions, which are things that aren't necessarily easy to get over doing, right? Because you want
right.
to do something well. The first time around. So do you have any pieces of advice to someone that wants to start and get going? What would you advise them?
I would say just put your mind to it. Get the whole mindset piece in place. Because once you have the mindset right, then you will just start in and go. And I made the commitment that I was going to write for an hour every evening on my first, after I got past the first two co-authored books. As I started writing them myself, I was going to commit to an hour every evening until I had the book written. And when I broke it down into a small piece of time like that, then it started happening. Otherwise, I sat there and just looked at a blank screen and says, I don't know how to do this. But when I committed to an hour an evening or a chapter a week or something like that, my book, Stop Overpaying Your Taxes, I sat down with that one and I just started thinking back over conversations I'd had with clients about different topics. And so that book has 11 ways entrepreneurs overpay and how to stop it now based on real conversations I've had with people. So that got the juices flowing there, and I committed on that one. I committed to a chapter a week, which took me, you know, about an hour an evening to get my chapter written. And broke it down into smaller, doable pieces instead of the idea, I'm going to do a book. Then there's virtual assistants and people like that out there who will get it edited for you. They'll help you get the covers designed. They'll help you get it out to Amazon CreateSpace and do a lot of that technical side because I don't know how to do the technical part. That's why I hire them, and they'll get it out there and get that piece of it taken care of because that part was really scary for me. I didn't know how to do that. So there's people that specialize in it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, if you don't mind, I'd like to shift gears again a little bit. And I'd like to get back to taxes. And one of the topics that you and I were talking about before we started recording here is the AMT, the Alternative Minimum Tax. So my question to you is, help our audience understand, what is it? What is this all about? How does the AMT work, the Alternative Minimum Tax?
Well, David, I'm going to give you the short answer, because if I gave you the long one, they would all say, I'm done, goodbye. So the short answer, this is Congress's way of making sure that higher-earning people pay at least a certain minimum rate of tax. So that keeps us from being able to do a whole bunch of deductions and stuff like that and drive that amount of taxable income down and potentially pay a lower rate of tax than somebody else would pay. So the AMT, they call it the equalizer tax, that it equalizes and it brings you back up to the rate, that minimum rate that they want you to pay. And it's a tax that sometimes appears to just kind of appear out of nowhere. Because I'll be working on a tax return, and it's like, whoa, where did that come from? I wasn't expecting that. And then you got to go back and stop and see, I can see all the different pieces that caused it to happen. Other times I'll be working on a tax return, and you're expecting it to happen, and it doesn't because of bits and pieces that are on the return, and it's a humongous list of stuff that we have to go through to justify whether it should or shouldn't be on a tax return. So I'm just going to call it an equalizer tax that makes sure you pay at least a certain minimum rate of tax that's high.
Well, it seems to me that a lot of physicians are kind of in that sweet spot.
Yes.
You know, when you're earning $200,000, $250,000, you're in that spot where you're starting to lose some of your deductions. And from what I understand of it, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, you know, when you're in that income bracket and you're trying to put as many deductions as you can to be proactive, that unfortunately you use enough of it, it seems to kick you then into AMT.
Right. And there's times that, you know, sometimes it's better to not deduct all of your itemized deductions or something like that, because it will, if you're hovering right on the edge of it. So it's not a very nice tax.
So is that something people can do to help avoid it? Maybe if they're on the edge of it and they might have to play with it with their tax preparer, that maybe they don't need to take all their itemized deductions, for example.
And that is something that you definitely want to explore if you're right on the edge. Other times you're far enough in that it doesn't matter.
Hmm.
But occasionally, if you move things from one place on a tax return to another, sometimes you can make it go away. Most of the time you can't. Most of the time it's just there.
Well, and from what I understand, too, once you're making a certain amount of money, you pretty much don't have to deal with AMT anyhow. Because
right.
You're paying enough in taxes.
Right, and you're paying enough, yep. That's why they have it in there, is to make sure that, you know, supposedly you're paying your fair share, but, you know, we all know what that means.
Well, can you think of any other ways that might be helpful to someone listening that could help them with AMT in particular?
AMT is a tough one because you start losing your itemized deductions. You're too high generally to get anything from your medical expenses as a write-off. It is a tough one. About the only other thing would be if you do have a lot of interest in dividends, to possibly look at maybe restructuring those into some tax-free type investments, because sometimes even though you earn a little less on them, By the time you factor in what it does to you on the tax return, you actually come out ahead. So, yeah, there's not a whole lot to work with when it comes to AMT. It's just a brutal tax.
Hmm. Well, and other tax things that I'm thinking about this time of the year here, when this podcast is coming out, we're going to be in the fall, and this is getting towards the end of the year. I think of things like tax loss harvesting is something good that people might be looking to do. Do you have any year-end thoughts, Diane, that might be good to pass on to people that they should be considering? Any other things year-end planning folks should be doing as the year wraps up here?
Well, another one I like to always suggest is charitable contributions, especially if you've got some appreciated stock that maybe you've been sitting on for a long time and you really don't want to sell it, because then you have to recognize those gains and you don't have any losses that you can harvest against it. Sometimes charitable deductions, where you actually gift that stock over to the charity, if you're old enough to, you have to, you know, there's certain age requirements and stuff on it, then you can take that, the whole deduction for what the fair market value of it is versus what you actually paid for it. So that's kind of a nice way to make that one work when it works. For anyone, well, actually, I'm going to back up on that one. That's just, you know, just regular gifting of appreciated stock. And then there's for those who are more at the retirement age, where they can actually make that whole process work through their IRA, and they can take it as a required minimum distribution. So that's a little bit to help towards the end of the year. Those things do require some, you know, more additional information and some planning before you just do them to make sure that they work and work well for you.
Absolutely. All good suggestions. And for those that aren't familiar, I had briefly mentioned tax loss harvesting. Diane, do you want to walk through what that is and why that might be important?
Tax loss harvesting is where you've sold some stocks or properties or whatever it might be in the past, and you've had this large loss that you have not been able to recognize on your tax return because we're limited to a measly $3,000 a year as an actual deduction. So if we know we have a piece of property, maybe it's a rental property or just a regular piece of property, or we've got some stocks or something in our portfolio that have a large gain on them, oftentimes we take a look at that gain and we look at these losses, and it might be a good time to go ahead and pull the trigger and sell that property, because we can offset that gain with the losses, and in essence, it means you're able to sell it without paying any taxes, as a really, really broad brushstroke type answer on that one. But it's a great way to use up some of those losses that can just sit there and roll forward at $3,000 a year practically forever.
Absolutely. Alternatively, if you're not using anything there right now, right? I mean, it's a great time to, if you have some positions with losses, which this year's been fairly volatile. If you have some positions sitting around with losses from the last couple of years, might be a good time to sell some of that and get that $3,000.
You bet. Yep. Start taking advantage of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Diane, there's so much we could be talking about with physicians and taxes, and we just don't have time to cover all of it. Do you have any closing thoughts that you'd like to pass on to our audience here?
I would say probably the most important thing is to take action on something that you've heard today. And I know we all get busy, and it's really easy to just say, that's really great information, and now we're off to the next thing. But take action on it. Find somebody who can help you. Pop onto my website and order a free copy of one of my books. Do something to start the ball rolling. Sign up for a free tax analysis, whatever it might be, but start that ball rolling so that this time next year you're not sitting in the same place that you are this year.
Absolutely. Great suggestion. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Diane. If people have more questions, where can they find you and how can they get in contact with you?
The best way to find me is to go out to www.taxcoachforyou, and the 4 is the number 4 instead of spelling it out. And on there, there's free, all kinds of free information they can download. We'd love to give away books and see if we can't help somebody. I offer a free tax analysis where that's where we take a look at your last 2 years, personal and or business tax returns, and I'm looking for mistakes or missed opportunities. We hop on the phone or Skype and set up an appointment to actually talk about your tax return and see what I found and see if we can come up with some tax-saving ideas for you.
Wonderful. Well, if you are listening, my friends, you're a physician, you want to tell your story, you're grappling with tough issues like these ones, I would love to hear from you. I'd love to hear your questions. I'd love to share it in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Or if you have specific tax questions you want to pass on to Diane, I'd be happy to address them here, and maybe she'd be kind enough to join us again. So make sure to contact me, Dave at drfreedompodcast.com, or on my website, www.drfreedompodcast.com. FreedomPodcast.com. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thank you so much for joining us. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes and check in again soon. Also, I have a big favor to ask of you. If you got some value from this podcast, I would like to ask you a favor. Can you take just a quick minute and do a review on iTunes? It really helps the show, and it would mean a lot to me. And so remember, my friends, make sure to cut your debt, cut your taxes, so you too can live a liberated lifestyle.
Hey, this is Dave Denniston. I hope you liked today's episode. If you do and you want some more ideas on achieving financial freedom, I am personally committed to increasing your financial knowledge. And we've talked today about a bunch of jargon. You may hear it tossed around. And so this month, my friends, I have a very special offer for you. You can pick up my book, The Freedom Formula for Physicians, for only $1. That's right, the whole copy, a whole physical copy you can hold in your hands for only $1. You can visit the podcast website now at www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar to pick up your copy. And my friends, I simply ask you help to pick up the cost of shipping for sending it to you. So don't let this podcast be like other ones where you hear great information, you get at new ideas, but you never actually complete anything. To snag your copy now, visit www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar. Again, that's www.drfreedompodcast.com/dollar.